Good evening. My name is Jane Riddle, and this is Brad Schaffer, and we're seniors at Boiling Springs High School. For the past month, we have participated in the high school mentoring program at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, Toxins, Toys to Toothpaste. Due to recent recalls of everyday items ranging from Barbie accessories to dog food, public awareness of dangerous toxins is increasing steadily. Materials once considered safe have recently been found to be more harmful than we ever would have suspected. Exposure to these substances, even at extremely low levels, has proven to be hazardous to fetal development and human health in general. Sometimes the consequences of these contaminants are not evident until late in life, a fact that underlines the importance of environmental health sciences. Discoveries in these sciences help to prevent the long-term harms associated with these toxins.
We are fortunate to have Dr. Pete Myers here this evening. Dr. Myers is the founder, CEO, and chief scientist of the Environmental Health Sciences. This nonprofit organization encourages public knowledge of developments in science research concerning ties between the environment and human health. Myers co-authored the book, Our Stolen Future, which highlights how contamination is currently endangering proper fetal development. He currently serves under numerous boards, including the John High Center for Science and Economics and the Environment. Dr. Myers earned his doctorate in biological sciences from the University of California, Berkeley, and his bachelor's degree from Reed College. At this time, I would like to ask you for the sound on your cell phones and other electronic devices be turned off. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation when there will be a short question and answer session. Out of courtesy to those who may be hearing impaired and because we are taping the event, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone to be passed to you when it's your turn. Thank you for your cooperation. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Pete Myers.
It is really wonderful to be here this evening. Can you all hear me? Excellent, excellent. Thank you for that superb introduction, both of you. Spent dinner learning about their future plans, and they're off to do great things. I want to thank the director of the Clark Forum, Harry Pullman, for this invitation. It's really an honor. I have some sense of the tradition here. My son, Dan, is a second-year student at Dickinson has told me the role that the Clark Forum plays in college life here, so I understand it's quite an honor for me to be invited. I've had fun all day meeting with students in classes, Mike Hyman's class, and students at lunch. What a great group of people. We face some serious challenges over the next couple of decades, but yes, you can. You can do this, and that's really good. I want to begin with a trip that tells us something about the world that we live in today, because it's very different than the world that I lived in when I was your age. I had the privilege for a dozen years of running a foundation, the W. Alton Jones Foundation. It took me all over the world. We did a lot of work in China. I'd love to have a chance to tell you about it. It's great fun. But on one of these trips to Western China, to a city called Kunming that you reach by flying many, many hours from the East Coast, then going to landing in Bangkok, then going up to Kunming, China, the red dot up there, then getting on a smaller plane and flying to a much smaller city called Zhangjiang, which, if you read this month's National Geographic, has been renamed Shangri-La to lure all of you there. It's very cold, so be careful. Anyway, so you fly to Zhangjiang, and that's where the plane system ends. And there you get in a jeep, and you drive for 2 days to the second red dot, and to get from there to Yubang, you go through this incredible landscape of that involves the Yangtze River, the Mekong River, enormous mountains, deep, deep valleys, in a jeep, It's really amazing landscape with classic rice terraces. So this is the Mekong River Valley near Yubing, the end of the road. So then you get to the end of the road, and you get on horses, and you go up over a 14,000-foot pass. They had the inflatable balloon there with oxygen in it because they didn't think the Westerners in the group could deal with the altitude. So you get to the top of this pass, and you look in this valley at the edge of the Himalayas. Those are the Himalayas in the background. This place is so far from serious transportation that it hasn't been deforested, which is really unusual in this part of China. You then go down into the valley, and there are yaks that have bells around their neck, and they're clanging. And you see these amazing birds. This is the Asian counterpart to our hummingbird. It's a Mrs. Gould's sunbird. And you also see people. This was a monk that I saw in the valley near the yaks, and I didn't have great camera equipment, so I apologize for the picture, the quality of the picture, but I saw him standing there. He was like this, and he had a tea kettle hanging from his elbow, and I could see his fingers going like this, and I'm thinking, oh, prayer beads. I wish I had a video camera. What a picture I could take back. And finally, I got close enough, and I realized it was a Game Boy. Okay. This was at the end of the road. And the Game Boy got there first. We live in a globalized civilization. Things we make travel everywhere on purpose and also accidentally because things are carried by the winds. We know there are a lot of big changes underway in what you might call the outer world. I'm sure everyone here is taking your course on climate change. Big changes underway. In fact, today there was a headline in Daily Climate about a brand new study saying that we can do a lot with steep emission cuts that are going to be serious enough to have some economic consequence, but we can no longer avoid significant warming during this century. It comes from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, published today. There's another type of big change in the outer world. It's symbolized by this picture of bark taken somewhere, I think, in Paraguay. And what it illustrates is the fact if you go and take samples of bark from any mature tree anywhere in the world, in the most remote place that you might want to travel, Belize, the Marshall Islands in the Pacific, Tasmania, you will find measurable concentrations of persisting organic pollutants in every sample of bark you measure as a result of the global distribution of contaminants that we have put out into the environment over the last 80 years. So these are big changes underway in the outer world. What about the inner world? What's happening there? Well, an organization called the Environmental Working Group obtained cord blood samples of 10 babies. And they used sophisticated chemical analysis to measure, they had the capability of detecting concentrations of 413 different industrial contaminants like persistent, like polychlorinated biphenyl, like DDT, like dioxin, many things that whose syllables are too long for me to say. And in those samples, they found an average of 200 of these industrial contaminants, a total of 271 out of the 413 industrial chemicals were found in those babies at birth. And they had gotten in there sometime during pregnancy. You can read about the outer world changes and the inner world changes daily at our two publications, Environmental Health News and Daily Climate. If you're interested in these issues, there's nothing like them, and they're free at those websites. But I want to focus on what those inner world changes mean for us and for health. And I think this may surprise you, but my core message is that there's some very good news that a scientific revolution that's underway in the environmental health sciences is leading us toward. This science is telling us, yes, the contamination is there, but if we remove it, if we take the proper policy steps to avoid exposure, actually, we are begin to be in a position to prevent many common diseases that science 10 years ago didn't tell us was preventable. That's really good news. We can do this at a time in the history of this species where for the first time in probably centuries, this generation of children is less healthy than their parents, in part because of the environmental factors I'm going to describe to you. So bottom line, if you leave with nothing else, remember that the revolution in environmental health sciences I'm going to describe to you is saying we are moving into a period of dramatic opportunities to prevent disease if we act on the science, and we can act on the science. Before I get into the details of the science, I want to ask some questions. I've got an analogy I'd like to use to put you in the right frame and a metaphor to tell you where I'm headed. Okay? So what are the questions? And I want you to raise your hands. Okay? How many of you, if you think about your families, your immediate families, and your close circle of friends, how many, within that circle, how many of you have experienced prostate cancer? Family's friend. Put your hand up. Prostate cancer. What about breast cancer? What about learning disabilities? What about infertility? What about type 2 diabetes? So now the last question is, if you put your hand up at least once, put it up again. And look around. There is almost no one person in the room who hasn't put up their hand once. And what the science is telling us, the science I'm going to summarize, is that some portion of each of those diseases may be preventable if we act on this science. Some portion. We don't know if it's 10% and we don't know if it's 50%. But it's really exciting to learn that there are some concrete things we can be doing to lower the human disease burden. So those are the questions. What about the analogy? So there's a lot of work here on energy, I know. So many of you will know who Amory Lovins is. Who knows who Amory Lovins is? Not as many. You guys aren't doing a good job. Come on. Yeah, okay. So Amory Lovins is an energy expert who in 1976 published a famous essay in the journal Foreign Affairs. And what did it say? Very simple. Amory said, the cheapest source of new energy is conservation. When he said that, every professional energy expert in the world laughed at him. They said, no, you got to drill. You got to drill more. You got to drill over there, drill here, drill deeper. 40 years of experience with Amy's prediction tells us he was right. Economies of the world have become much more energy efficient. They have saved money, and it's proven to be a much cheaper source of new energy than drilling in lots of different places. Well, the science that I'm going to describe to you tonight puts us in a phase of environmental health science that's analogous to where Amory was 40 years ago. What do I mean? When I talk to medical specialists about this science, medical specialists who have not been paying attention to the new science, but who have been treating patients as they should be doing, they laugh. They say, that's ridiculous. But I'm telling you, this science not only is going to help us, if we act on it, not only is it going to help us reduce the disease burden, it's going to contribute significantly reducing the cost of healthcare. That's a prediction. Okay? Now, finally, the metaphor. One of the core realizations of this field of science that's unfolded in the last 15 years and wasn't there before comes out of the realization that how a fetus develops in the womb can have lifelong consequences for that individual. Here is the metaphor. Think. Let's imagine you're the Coast Guard, okay? And what's your job? Your job in this particular case is to guard the movement of a boat from New York to London, or to guard the lifetime of an individual following birth
to the end of life. Okay.
Now, the traditional way of guarding the boat is to protect against bombs being dropped on it, large assaults. Just like most toxicologists have focused on high doses and the consequences of those high doses. But this new science says, it's not the high doses. We know about high doses. Those are a problem. We haven't been focusing on the orientation of the compass. Because if that ship takes off from New York, and its compass is 1 degree off, almost imperceptibly off, it's going to wind up on a rocky shore in France instead of in London. And it's the same, you've got to think the same way about that developing fetus. If its developmental pathway is shifted slightly, it can have serious health problems all the way through old age. Does that make sense? And I'll give you some specific examples of that. So, this revolution in science is forcing the field as a whole to think very differently about links. What are plausible links between environmental contamination and human health, including chronic diseases of adulthood? It's leading us to discover things about products we've let into our homes that we thought were safe and aren't. But again, the bottom line message is creating enormous opportunities to prevent diseases we didn't think were preventable. And what does this mean? It means basically the traditional tools we have been using to develop the health standards that our government has in place to protect us from exposure, they were highly likely to have underestimated the types of effects I'm talking about today. They've not done a good job at that. But they can do a much better job if we use this science to develop a new generation of health standards. And when we do, people are going to be healthier. There are four key discoveries in this revolution. The first is that some contaminants alter gene behavior at extremely low levels of exposure. And I'll get into what I mean by that. A second is that the standard protocols that our government and other governments have depended upon to predict what consequences are of low exposure, which involve using high doses and then extrapolating those, thinking that that allows them to predict what will happen at low doses, it doesn't work for some types of contaminants, the types of contaminants I'm going to be talking about today. A third key discovery, which is illustrated by the cord blood data, where those babies had over 200 contaminants in them at birth, mixtures are part of the story. All of us have hundreds of industrial contaminants in our blood. All the standards that have been developed to protect us are based on chemicals taken one at a time. And yet we know that chemicals in us, in our bodies, interact in ways that aren't predictable by those experiments done one at a time. Does that make sense? And finally, adult chronic diseases, as I mentioned earlier, can be programmed early during development. And it's these four discoveries, these themes, that are changing our perceptions of what is possible about preventing environmentally induced diseases. I can tell most of this story with this one slide. Two mice. The mice are representative of an experimental group and a control group. This is work done by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, part of National Institute of Health. The experimental group is on your right. The control group is on your left. These animals, basically, they're the same strain of mouse. They had the same caloric intake as they grew up. And they had the same activity level. There are no statistically distinguishable differences between caloric intake and activity level between the experimental mouse and the control mouse, and yet the experimental mouse is grotesquely obese. What happened? Right around birth, that obese mouse was exposed to one part per billion of a synthetic estrogen, a molecule that mimics the human hormone estrogen called diethylstilbestrol, which has a sordid history in health, and I can describe the details to you if we have time, but it's representative of a class of contaminants called estrogen mimics, some of which are used pharmaceutically, and some of which happen to be in products that are in our homes by accident. So one, and those other products actually can produce, some of them we know can produce the same effect. Scientists are pretty far along in understanding how that happens. And it turns out that DES in this case, and bisphenol A in another case, and the organotins in yet a third case, they stimulate a gene called PPAR gamma that increases the likelihood that stem cells will be converted to fat cells as this animal is growing. So this animal grows up with more fat cells than it would have had, which means it's more efficient at absorbing lipids. And then that's why it becomes fat. Okay, so that's point one. A very small amount can cause a really big effect. The second part of this, let's imagine you take that experimental mouse at right at birth, and instead of exposing it to one part per billion, you expose it to 1,000 parts per billion. 1,000 times as much. Is it going to become a balloon? Actually, no. It's going to lose weight compared to the control. It's going to be scrawny. It's going to be thinner than the control. Okay? And obviously, this is a developmental event. Exposure was right around birth. The consequences were visible in middle to late age in the mouse. So these are three pieces to that story. Low levels can matter. High-level tests, if a high level of DES, you get a skinny mouse. That doesn't predict that a low level of test, you're going to get an obese mouse, does it? Just the opposite. And finally, early life exposures can impair adult health. So if you step back and look at the core issue at play here, what's underlying this revolution? It's actually the genetic basis of many human diseases. Now, when I say that, a lot of people scratch their heads. They say, wait a second, Pete, you were talking environment, and now you're talking genes. And isn't that apples and oranges? Well, the problem is that there are two ways to think about genes. We get genes through inheritance, and it does matter what gene you get in the first place. But those genes aren't passive things that lie still in your bodies for your lives. They are being turned on and off trillions of times a second. They're chemical manufacturing machines. They're nature's nanotechnology. They're controlling the production of proteins that you need at the right time to be healthy. And they're under the control system. They're under the control of epigenetic factors, a term of art, which influence when genes can be turned on and off. Okay, and it's that behavior of turning genes on and off which is the heart of this story. Because if a gene is turned on at the wrong time, or it doesn't turn on when you need it, that's when the compass can shift and you wind up going along the wrong course. So what changes gene expression? Well, you got to have the gene in the first place for it to be turned on, and genes are sending signals to one another all the time, controlling the expression of other genes. But it also turns out that a lot of research now shows diet, stress, experience, and certain environmental contaminants can alter gene expression. There's a growing list of environmental contaminants that at environmental levels of exposure, what we experience can alter gene expression. Here's the list. I'm going to focus on the first one because most of the there's more science with respect to bisphenol A than the others, but the list is growing quite large. What this focus on gene expression does is it takes that old dichotomy of nature versus nurture, genes versus environment, and it sort of flips it on its head. Okay? It does matter what genes you inherit, but the environmental factors that influence the genes that you inherit can be just as important for your health as whether you got the gene in the first place. So just one example. How many of you have heard of BRCA1, the breast cancer gene? There's a mutant form of the breast cancer gene that if you happen to have it, and it's transmitted familially through inheritance, if you happen to have it, you have a high likelihood of developing breast cancer. But only 5% of women have that form of the gene. It's not explaining most cases. Within the family, that family, yeah, it explains a lot. But there's 95% that isn't explained. On the other hand, if you look at just one of the sort of epigenetic factors that control gene expression called methylation, 60% of women with breast cancer have altered methylation of the correct form of the gene, so it isn't able to be turned on when they need it. Does that make sense? So, we used to think that when we heard that a disease was under genetic control, that meant it was inherited. Okay? Now, because of this new focus on epigenetics, gene behavior, all of a sudden, a disease that the Human Genome Project links to a gene, actually, some of it might be inherited. In fact, it couldn't be detected by the Human Genome Project unless some portion of that disease were inherited. But some fraction of it actually may be caused by environmental factors that are altering the expression of that gene. So when I read, when the Human Genome Project publishes yet another study about this disease is linked to that gene, which they do, and I love their work, most of the public reacts by saying, oh my God, did I get that form of the gene? As a very fatalistic response, because there's very little you can do in the way of prevention if it's due to an inherited gene. I ask the question, what labs in the world are working on environmental factors that could be changing that gene's expression? And if there are, and we can reduce the exposures, and it's contributing materially to the disease burden of that problem, we've got to win. That's a really different way to think about it. We used to think in this field that we had to focus on high levels of exposure, things that if you worked in a factory you might experience, think if you lived around a Superfund site or downwind of a chemical factory. This changes that equation because we're finding that effects can be linked plausibly to levels that we'd all sort of become inured to thinking as normal and background levels. Levels that literally could not be measured 20 years ago. The politics is this is really interesting because what this means is this is about everyone in this room. It's not about unfortunate communities, disadvantaged communities who are forced to live near factories. It's about everyone in this room. We all have to solve this problem together, and we all get healthier together. We used to think, as I said, with respect to mixtures, we used to do all these studies chemical by chemical, one chemical at a time. We know that they interact unpredictably with each other, and not only with each other, but they combine with other forces, including social factors and stress and poor diet, to make vulnerable populations even more vulnerable. So I said I was going to focus on bisphenol A. Now, bisphenol A was first invented in 1891 by a Russian chemist. There's the monomer of bisphenol A. In 1936, it was discovered by a Nobel laureate, an endocrinologist, that bisphenol A is a synthetic sex hormone. It behaves like estrogen. Well, the assays of the day said, at the time, there was a frantic search for synthetic estrogens that could be used medicinally. This didn't quite measure up. So they basically put it on the shelf. And 10 years or so later, a polymer chemist, the sort of scientist that takes interesting molecules and see if they can combine them into chains to make plastic, discovered that bisphenol A made polycarbonate plastic, which has some really valuable characteristics, including being hard and rigid and it can hold water. The problem is that the ester bonds that bind the monomer together are vulnerable to hydrolysis at relatively mild conditions. So over time, with use, the bonds break down and bisphenol A goes into contact. It seeps into the materials that are in containers like this. Bisphenol A has been used to make polycarbonate baby bottles. Canada today finalized a ban on that use of bisphenol A today. It's also used to make an epoxy rosin, that lines the cell, at least 80% of the food cans sold in the U.S. market today. And if you think about hydrolysis and the vulnerability to degradation of that bond, when you put really hot food in a can to sterilize it, a lot of the bisphenol A is actually sucked into the food. Well, so what does that mean? Traditional toxicology would have said the levels that you're seeing leach into food or baby milk or whatever, they're in the parts per billion level. It's irrelevant. And if you actually go and sample people, and these are representative samples from Germany, you see somewhere between 4 and 15 parts per billion in fetal blood, maternal blood, and placental blood. And traditional toxicology would have said that doesn't matter. It's too low to matter. Let's think for a moment what a part per billion is. Oh, by the way, these levels can be measured in 95% of Americans today. What is a part per billion? Any chemists in the room? Oh, come on, there have to be chemists in the room. Excellent, excellent. You can answer the question. Not the first question, you answer the second question. So what's a part, how do most people think about a part per billion? Okay. Well, a part per billion is one pancake in a stack of pancakes 4,000 miles high. Very tiny amount. But let's imagine a bottle of water, and you take one drop out of that bottle, and the concentration of bisphenol A is one part per billion. How many molecules of bisphenol A do you think are in that bottle of water, or in that drop of water? There are 132 billion. You've all heard of Avogadro's number, right? Even if you aren't chemists, okay? It turns out that BPA operates at such an extraordinarily low level that that number of molecules can actually cause serious damage. This became an issue. This was first raised about 15 years ago by a scientist at the University of Missouri named Fred von Saal, and he was not a toxicologist. He was a reproductive biologist studying what controls male and female behavior in the womb, and he worked with mice. And he had been studying prostate development, and he was reading about bisphenol A as a synthetic estrogen. He said, that would be an interesting tool to use in my experiments. They're not toxicology, but let's just look at it. And, estradiol binds with serum binding proteins, so it's not very available in our serum, but bisphenol A doesn't bind with serum binding proteins, so it's actually biologically really available. And so von Saal did these calculations that said, given that, at what level should I see an effect in this fetal development process of the prostate? And he calculated he should see an effect at 2 parts per billion, exposes the female to 2 parts per billion while she's pregnant, and then he then sees a 35% increase in the prostate weight of the adult male after birth. He also sees a hypersensitization of the adult male of the prostate throughout life to further hormonal stimulation, which is not a good idea. This was a highly controversial result, and I can go into the controversy at length in the question and answer period. It's been replicated now. What you need in science, it's been replicated multiple times. It's been extended with fantastic analyses, reconstructions of what the developing prostate looks like, how it achieves that difference in weight. But what von Saal did was he said, we've been thinking the wrong way about what low-dose exposures might mean. He really began to push this issue. And since that, the research into low-dose exposures and how it affects fetal development and how it actually interferes with some adult processes has exploded with bisphenol A, with the phthalates, with a wide array of chemical contaminants that we have allowed into our lives. As one example, exposure right around birth to 10 parts per billion causes adult prostate cancer in rats. And it does it. It's the mechanism, the genetic mechanisms are fascinating. It alters the methylation patterns of a key gene that in adulthood is supposed to shut down proliferation of cells. But if it's been exposed in the womb to bisphenol A, that methylation doesn't take place, and so the adult cells, which should not be dividing, are dividing and proliferating. And that leads to these pin lesions. It turns out that there are risks to adults that we've identified. This one is why I'm worried personally about bisphenol A. It interferes with the standard treatment for prostate cancer in adult men. And we have an idea now about what some of the molecular genetic mechanisms are. And this is done in rats, but it's done using the rat models that are used to develop medicine to treat prostate cancer in people. So the research is highly relevant. Prenatal exposure to parts per trillion levels of bisphenol A causes breast cancer in adult rats. And in adult breast cancer cells that are estrogen sensitive, which is a common form of breast cancer, one part per billion, which is a level that's very common in people in this room, antagonizes, it works against, it shuts down common agents used in breast cancer chemotherapy. The inside of a mouse, can you take it? One mouse inside slide tonight. This is a normal mouse, okay? You can see it's got healthy-looking kidneys. Trust me, those are healthy-looking kidneys. It's a male because it's got testes. You can barely see the bladder. So what happens if that mouse were exposed to 20 parts per billion as it's developing in the womb, and then you allow it to grow to my age in mouse years? If this mouse had been allowed to live just a few more days, its bladder would have exploded. Its kidneys are already necrotic. They aren't working. So this is a dead mouse. They discovered this because they were trying to get mice to grow old enough to see if the pin lesions of prostate cancer developed into prostate cancer, true metastatic prostate. But they couldn't get them to survive this phenomenon. How did this happen? It turns out that there's a key tissue in the mesenchyme, a key tissue in the urethra, which is the tube that connects the bladder to the outside world, whose methylation patterns are changed during that fetal exposure. So as it is aging, it responds differently to changes in the balance between testosterone and estrogen, which normally happen as a male ages. And instead of staying open, the tissue constricts to the point that it shuts the urethra completely, and the animal can't pee anymore. Think of that boat. Tiny changes in the course it takes as it's leaving the port can have profound effects late in life. Urologists are really excited about this work because it's the first animal model of a syndrome that's becoming increasingly common in people called obstructive bladder syndrome. And they're using it. They're working with the scientist on this. They're using it. He makes the mice take this developmental course, and they start experimenting with drugs that could save the mouse, and also using stents to keep the urethra open. That's in very early stages of research. So this issue was big, I think, in the eyes of people tracking environmental health sciences. But then this past summer, it took a huge leap forward when two results appeared that have to do with type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. We used to think that fat tissue was a passive place in your body to store fat. Well, now we know it's a part of the endocrine system, and it secretes hormones. It responds to hormonal signals. It's very active tissue. One of the hormones that it secretes is adiponectin. Adiponectin has been shown in long-term epidemiological research to protect against heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Higher levels of adiponectin are good for you. Bisphenol A, in experiments with human fat cells, in human fat tissue, show that right at the range, see that low point in the graph, right at the range where most people in this country are exposed, which is about one part per billion, 1 to 2 parts per billion. That's where bisphenol A is most effective at suppressing adiponectin levels. Okay. That's bad. So that was some in vitro work, work with cells. And then the nuclear bomb went off. These results predict that BPA will be linked to heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Well, that was then published in the Journal of American Medical Association in September, showing that odds ratios for a variety of components of metabolic disorder, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, heart attacks, are increased in people with somewhat elevated but not super elevated levels of bisphenol A in their blood. These are CDC data, over 1,500 people in the study. This is the first major epidemiological study done with bisphenol A, and people are working hard right now to replicate these results. The last of these, I'll skip that. So in animal studies, low doses of bisphenol A have been linked to a wide array of health conditions. And you got to ask, how does one compound get involved in so much chicanery? It turns out bisphenol A alters, we now know, it alters at least the expression of over 200 different genes. And these aren't genes that are at the periphery of gene cascades controlling your hair color. They are genes vital to how cell growth is regulated and cell signaling is controlled. This looks like a complicated graph. It's not, but it makes a really important point. How many times have you read something about this research and someone will say, oh, it's all about high-dose experiments? Those doses are not relevant to what people experience. Well, what this graph shows, that black line is the average of all the others, and what it shows is the estimated serum concentration in animals involved in experiments where adverse effects were found, a bunch of different adverse effects, like that list that I just showed you. And it shows how, because of metabolic treatment of degradation of bisphenol A, the serum level decreases as time goes on after treatment, okay? So the question is, how do those levels in the animals compare to the average levels in people? Are they high compared to those people, compared to people level, or are they low compared to what's in us today according to the Centers for Disease Control? Well, that's the average level in people today in the U.S. It's about 2 parts per billion. So these experiments are working at levels that are lower than what we experience. There are differences between people and animals. The endocrine system is relatively conserved, so there aren't huge differences, but there are differences, and that may, and actually people have up to 50-fold differences in how they treat certain types of, how they metabolize certain types of contaminants. But this is not a good place to be. How did we get here? How did the systems we have depended upon to protect us wind us up being allowing products that are putting these potentially dangerous compounds in our homes, because that's where the exposure comes from? Well, it turns out that we use a process called risk assessment to guide the establishment of acceptable daily intake for people. And then we go through a series of calculations that say, okay, this ought to be safe. There's some key assumptions underlying that process. One is that there is a safe dose below which exposure doesn't matter. A second is a particular way of thinking about the dose response curve. Traditional toxicology assumes that the dose makes the poison, that as the dose increases, the effect is going to be bigger. It assumes that the curve is, it could be nonlinear with some squiggles in it, it could be linear, but it never has the slope change sign. It never goes down and then goes up again, or goes up and then goes down again. Those are called non-monotonic dose response curves. And that is a core assumption of how the regulatory process works, that those don't exist in nature. Think of that fat mouse. So what they do is they establish, through a series of high-dose tests, they establish what they think is a safe level where they no longer see an effect, and then they use some safety factors to predict at a fat perhaps 1,000-fold below, there won't be an effect, and it's safe, and that's acceptable exposure. The problem is, the tests are done at high doses. No one confirms the safety of low doses. It's simply assumed. Predicted safe doses are not tested. And unfortunately, as a class of compounds called endocrine disruptors, which is what our a book I wrote was about, Our Stolen Future, what we have learned is that just like hormones themselves, endocrine-disrupting compounds, hormone-disrupting compounds, can have these odd-shaped dose-response curves, where at some point in the curve, the response goes up, and another, it goes down, or vice versa. And we're getting some understanding of the molecular genetics underlying this, not complete understanding, and there are several different models. One is that at the high doses, the compound isn't the mechanism is working through is not turning genes on and off. It's through overt toxicity. It just kills. Whereas at low doses, it's hormonally active and it's upregulating genes. Another model that's been shown in multiple labs is as you move along the dose response curve, at one level, in the, at one serum concentration, you have one suite of genes being upregulated. And at another level, you have a completely different suite. So you can't, and you can't predict which suite of genes is being upregulated from one dose to another. Let me take you through a thought experiment here. I could go into each of those examples if people want to hear them, because they're, to me, they're fascinating. How many of you know what tamoxifen is? Tamoxifen is a really important pharmaceutical agent for treating breast cancer. And why is it useful? It's useful because at high doses, the doses that your physician wants in you when you have a breast tumor, it suppresses the growth of the tumor. It's toxic to the tumor. Okay. Physicians, however, have known for a long time that there's something called the tamoxifen flare that takes place at a dose about a million times beneath the therapeutic dose, in which it's actually an estrogen. It stimulates the growth of the tumor. This is why it's really important, as women are using tamoxifen, for them to stay on treatment, because if they let their treatment slide, they risk going into the zone where, in fact, the opposite, the effect that they want, that they get, will be just the opposite. So let's do a thought experiment with this, and then we'll pretend we're going to develop a safe level for tamoxifen, using standard procedures that the EPA and the FDA are using today for environmental chemicals. So you begin by doing a series of experiments, working down the dose response curve. And here you see it was statistically different from the control, which is the line. That one is. But then the next one there's no difference. So that's called the no observed adverse effect level. And that's what you then base your extrapolations upon to reach what the safe level might be. And what you do is you say, okay, well, people differ. Kids aren't little adults, so let's divide that by 10, okay? And then let's also divide it by 10 because animals aren't people. And then actually I conflated two. The three factors are kids aren't little adults, there's variation among people, and animals are not people. And those for each of those, they divide by 10, so they wind up dividing by 1,000. And what does that do? That puts you at the acceptable level, estimate of acceptable level, right in the most dangerous zone for use of tamoxifen. Every public health standard focused on environmental chemicals that is used, that is in place in this country today, uses that logic. For many chemicals that don't display this type of dose response curve, it's probably not a problem. But for things that behave like hormones, there are many examples where it in animal work has been shown to be a problem, and yet the regulatory approach has not changed. It's in the scientific Jurassic. So there are four key discoveries in this revolution. Some contaminants can alter gene expression at extremely low levels. High-dose experiments won't predict those low-dose effects if the chemical has this hormone-like non-monotonic dose response pattern. Mixtures are really important. And adult chronic diseases can be programmed during development. The tools we have used to establish safety standards have been blind to these effects for decades. There's bad news in this, and there's good news.
The bad news is that we have developed products that carry some contaminants doing this into our homes. And as a result, we have body burdens that are significant and within the range that current science indicates may be a problem. We know that the tools we've depended upon in these instances can't be trusted upon to find real effects. But let's go back to my opening. There's really good news here. Remember that a disease under genetic control may be one that's being caused by the sort of genetic hijacking that I've been talking about this evening. We're going to have the ability to prevent those cases of those diseases that we didn't realize looking at this in the old way might be preventable. Regulations can be improved. We can make safer products. We can have processes that are designed more efficiently to avoid exposures. We have some fabulous examples of public policy reducing exposures of people in this country. Lead. Our lead levels of kids today are 10% of what they were when I was growing up. And the consequences for what we understand are the links between lead exposure during early development and IQ is that that's been a huge boon for the economy of the United States because IQ is linked to income. We can do a better job. There's a lot more science we have to gather. Science never ends. Always new questions. It's one of the fun parts of this job. But I think that we know enough now for many of the issues that I've been talking about in the contaminants, that we know enough now to start incorporating this new science into a new generation of precautionary health standards. We also should be using this new science to give design signals to a field that's emerging called green chemistry. I've been working intensively with green chemists for the last several years, realizing what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, okay, so Pete, bisphenol A is a problem because it binds with the estrogen receptor. Why does it bind with the estrogen receptor? It binds because of the molecular conformation of bisphenol A. Is there a way we can make that molecule or a molecule like it that can't bind with estrogen receptor but can be polymerized into a clear, hard plastic that we can use to hold water? And the answer is definitely yes. But chemists never viewed that as their responsibility before. The process heretofore has been chemists design a new molecule, chemical engineers create a great new product that has a lot of fantastic material characteristics that everyone wants, a whole lot of economic growth that's built around that new product. Bisphenol A is worth $800,000 an hour to the companies that produce it. So you wind up in a situation where they don't want to lose that. And not in a situation where, wait a second, if the chemists had been working hand in hand with the environmental health scientists right at the outset, it never would have made it to market. But something else would have that would provide the services that we need. Chemistry is good. It provides things we need. But we can do a better job with design signals to make the chemicals provide those services without creating the health risks. Public policy can make a difference fast in this. I mentioned the lead example. That took a couple decades. How many of you know what chlorpyrifos is, or Dursban? It's a neurotoxin that was used, get this, it was used as a nerve gas in World War I. And then it was used as a pesticide and allowed into homes over the last 30 years. Okay? That wasn't thought through very carefully. Anyway, chlorpyrifos, trade name, it's sold under the name Dursban. Epidemiological studies have shown in inner city communities in New York City, Dominican Heights and Harlem, that moms with slightly elevated levels of Dursban during pregnancy wind up with kids, with babies that are smaller. And small baby at birth is a bad sign for future health. It has consequences throughout, it's linked to consequences throughout the life of the baby. So what happened? In 2000, the EPA negotiated a voluntary phase-out with the companies that made chlorpyrifos. convinced them that the writing was on the wall and that they should take it off the market. It didn't have the law didn't allow them to force it off the market. The laws that we have today on this stuff are much better protecting products than protecting people. But the EPA had sufficient data that said, you know, you guys don't want to do this. There are going to be suits against you. They're going to be, so just take it off voluntarily. And they did. And what happened? Within a year, the effect on birth size had disappeared. They were already, within a year of taking this compound off the market, babies in Harlem and Dominican Heights were being born healthier as a result of public policy. That's totally cool. So, you look at today's epidemics, hormone-related cancers, endometriosis, autism, degenerative cancers or diseases, preterm birth, asthma. I didn't have time to go into the science related to all these. I barely touched on it related to a few. But if you go into this revolution in environmental science and you dig into the literature, you'll find substantial publications providing plausible links for each of these to environmental exposures. Now, some of them are going to fall off the chart as additional science grows, and we can reject some hypotheses. But for some, it's going to go stronger. And as it grows stronger, the evidence and the argument for intervening to reduce those exposures that are linked to these diseases is going to grow, the pressure is going to grow, and we're going to be able to take action. I'm most excited by this one because it's the biggest public health problem we face. $217 billion a year in healthcare costs for the U.S. because of type 2 diabetes. And we now have some clues from multiple sources saying that certain types of environmental exposures may be tied to that. What an amazing opportunity this could provide us to help control that suite of diseases and the extraordinary burden on the health economy that it imposes. I think this new science is moving us, if we can act on it, this new science is moving us toward a time when that comment I made at the outside will no longer be valid, where this generation of kids is less healthy than their parents. We can move to a new generation where, in fact, they continue along that trajectory that went on for literally centuries, where every generation of kid was healthier than their parents. That's where we need to be, and I thank you for listening to me this evening. And I'm happy to answer questions.
I'm wondering if there are any research projects going on right now that links mental illness to environmental.
Very definitely. And that's a part of the literature that I am not as familiar with as the reproductive tract and cancer effects that I talked about. But unquestionably, I mean, the clues from the Human Genome Project, schizophrenia is linked to genes. Some fraction of schizophrenia is familially based, inherited. But most of it's not. I go back to a question I asked before. Who's looking for factors that interfere with the expression of the genes that we know from the Human Genome Project are linked to schizophrenia? And there is research underway on that, especially in relation to adult neurodegenerative diseases.
Part of the reason for the dose response curve, like estimating 1,000 times lower, I don't want to really say laziness, I guess. Lack of funding?
Yeah, it is an expense issue.
Not to be overly cynical here, but is it possible to get the funding to, you know, test all these chemicals out there and...
Not all of them. There are 80,000 that have been brought into market over the last century, and most of them have not been tested to any degree, anywhere near close to what we would like. But we can identify those that are, first of all, what you do is say, okay, 80,000 aren't in people. What's in people? And especially what's in the fetus?
Let's target that first, and let's target those that have particular types of characteristics that we know, for example, can interact with a hormone system. We can narrow that window. And then we start doing things like, and this is amazing thinking pioneered by Sweden, where about 10 years ago, they said, you know, we can't test 80,000 chemicals. We know their problems. Let's try and think through creatively about how we would develop sustainable chemical industry in Sweden that encourages industry to do the right thing, but acknowledges that we've been blindsided in the past. And so the first thing they did, they said, you know, we haven't tested every persistent organic pollutant for every possible effect, things like DDT and PCBs and polybromated diphenyl ethers, things that stick around for a long time and work up the food chain in a more concentrated way. They said, we haven't been able to test all of those, but we know every time we have, ultimately we found a problem. So the first design criteria we're going to use for sustainable chemistry in Sweden is within 10 years, we want persistent organic pollutants as a class out of products and processes. And they gave them 10 years because it's going to take a while to figure out the chemistry. But they said, come 10 years from now, we want them out. So that's the sort of thinking that's one avenue of thinking that people are using to try and get through this very difficult challenge. It's not easy.
So far, is there any scientific explanation of why certain chemicals can change the genetic expression at a low dose instead of at a high dose?
Actually, there is some insight into that. There's a guy named Toshi Yoshida at Harvard Medical School who's the lead researcher into using what are called microarrays for looking at gene expression. And what he's finding, first of all, is it's a reproducible effect across a wide array of materials, pharmaceuticals, and compound and contaminants. Second, that as I said earlier, the simplest explanation is when you go so high in the dose response curve that you are overtly toxic and it's no longer working through changes in gene expression. With respect to the changes at, you know, this suite of genes at one level is upregulated versus this other suite of genes at another level, that's something just people, to my knowledge, are just beginning to crack. It's one of the most exciting areas of research in this field.
Maybe I didn't understand you right. This chemical, biphenyl A, is in all cans now?
It's in most cans, yes.
Most, but not all.
There are some cans that have purposely avoided using the can lining that's based on, unfortunately, you can't tell by looking. Now, if you go, for example, to some, there are some cans that explicitly state on them, this is lined with a water-based rosin, or this is bisphenol A-free, and we're seeing more examples of that. But the consumer pressure to force that labeling is only now building.
What about these plastic bottles, the mineral water? It comes with plastic bottles.
The mineral water bottles do not contain appreciable amounts of bisphenol A.
But something else, luckily today, many products, they don't have preservatives. The frozen food, that is great, but how much influence does science have on the production of food? For instance, sauerkraut, first of all, the fermentation keeps it preserved, and secondly, mm-hmm. It is in package sterilized. Why does it have a preservative?
And that's not an area I'm an expert in.
How much influence you have to forbid somehow these chemicals all in the food? It's too much.
It's definitely too much.
Do you have any influence?
I have less influence than I would like.
This is probably a good follow-up question. Your optimism for the science is good, but as consumers and as voters, how do we react to the information that you're providing?
Great question. And a frequent question I get in a setting like this is, you know, a young mom will say, why do I have to be a chemical engineer to go shopping for my kids? I got enough things to worry about. This isn't right. But unfortunately, that's the way the system works today. We are seeing, on the other hand, a growing consumer pressure, growing political pressure to force major changes in both specific legislation targeting specific compounds, but also, most exciting to me, major reforms in the almost 40-year-old laws that govern exposure to contaminants in this country, the Toxic Substance Control Act. Either this week or next week, Senator Lautenberg from New Jersey will be introducing a bill in the Senate called the Kids Safe Chemical Act that actually moves along the lines that I responded to you. It says we're going to prioritize the things we find in kids and in fetuses and in babies. And we're going to begin to put the manufacturers on notice that if their chemical shows up in those samples, they've got to be generating data to show us it's safe. So reversing the burden of proof. And there's some challenges to that, and the legislation right now isn't perfect, but it's the direction it's moving. There are, especially because of the, I'm sure you all heard about lead in toys from China and, you know, the Chinese drywall issues and the salmonella. The public is conflating all of those into one core issue, which is the current system is broken. It's not protecting us. Let's change it. And members of Congress, including both Republican and Democratic senators from this state, recognize that. And they're in varying degrees of helpfulness in moving that forward. The Kids Safe Chemical Act, my understanding of the politics is that it's going to be fought over in this session and probably not passed, but passed in the next session of Congress. But that's so different from where we were 5 years ago. It's astounding the sort of public momentum that is building to address this problem in the political arena.
We have time for one more question.
Okay. Your last answer answered the question that I had, but I'll pose another one.
Yeah.
One of the difficulties that we often are dealing with in public policy areas where science interfaces with it is how do we deal with issues of uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard enough using the old toxicology,
right,
and trying to legislate and regulate based upon scientific information about which we may have some sense of distributions, mm-hmm, and error bounds and whatnot. The areas that you're talking about, this very new science, I'm assuming there's a fair amount of uncertainty related to this. How does one deal with that in the legislative regulatory framework? Is this pose a different challenge from the old toxicology issues with uncertainty, just a different magnitude, or are they very easily handled?
The uncertainty of science and the disconnect between the insistence of certainty by politicians to act is one of the great impediments to progress here. Scientists revel in uncertainty. That's their job, is to find it and point to it. And that means that their communications often are ineffective in the public arena because that's what they want to talk about. That's what they want to fight about. And so one of that's great. But there reaches a point where you know enough to start to act. And so one of the things, actually pioneered by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was approaching this as a hierarchy of certainty. The first executive summary of the IPCC in 1990 had this amazing document that said, we are certain of the following. We're pretty confident of this. Here's some really interesting questions, and we don't know anything about this. Okay. Well, this field has emulated what the IPCC did in a range of issues, saying, here are a suite of issues we are confident in, and we can begin to base policy decisions upon. Here are some others where we're not yet there yet. And then the purpose of science is to move the things up the certainty chain. And that process for each of the things I talked about is in different stages. What the IPCC did, which was brilliant, very simple but brilliant, is it put the certainty first. And politicians only read the first paragraph. Okay? It put all the uncertainty at the last, and scientists are going to read every
word, okay? And so it satisfied the science because the uncertainty was acknowledged and they could fight with their friends, but it satisfied the media and the politicians because, hey, they agree about this. That's a fascinating way to let these very different communities, science, politics, and media, look at the same body of information and find things in it that were useful.
On behalf of the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues, please join me in thanking Dr. Pete Myers for his presentation tonight. Thank you for attending. This concludes our program.